Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have with me William T. Volman, who's written a book called Writing Toward Everywhere. It's published by Echo, and it's one of his nonfiction books. His novel, well, really, it's a collection of samples and slices, Europe Central, won the National Book Award. His recent books include Poor People, another work of documentation. He's done a recent small book about Copernicus. There is the seven-volumed Rising Up and Rising Down, Some Thoughts on Violence, Freedom, and Urgent Means, which has been put in a single abridged paperback volume, also by Echo, and many novels as well that include an ongoing history of the North American continent and alternating virtually with stories about the present. This book is a book about train hopping, and it kind of amazes me. I've been reading reviews of this book, and the reviewers seem not to notice that the very sentences of the book are like a train hopping experience. They speed up, they slow down, they go on unpredictable places, they take you places where you hadn't expected to go, tracks meet and shift, and so sentences go off in the opposite direction from the one in which they started. And I wanted to talk to you about that style because it is very different from the more naturalistic style of your recent work.
Well, yeah, I think that's right, Michael. By the way, thanks for having me back. It's great to see you again and talk to you again. I guess I feel that as I'm getting older, I want to make sure that I have really lived my life. And part of living my life means seeing more stars in the night sky, seeing more physical reality, making sure that I understand the limits of what is in my head. So as I go out into this larger world a little bit and try to learn whatever I can, I see random things, grimy things, beautiful things, and I can't know where I'm going. As Thoreau says, you know, if we accept the fact that we're ignorant, then we actually have a chance to grow. And so the sentences, the language, the book itself do not always know or care exactly what the destination will be. When I was finishing this book, Cormac McCarthy's The Road came out, and I was thinking that, of course, is the life that a real hobo would be living, and how awful it would be to live that life, much more awful than the life that we are living now. But the life we are all living now seems to be getting more and more awful by degrees. The control of thought, the fear, acceptance of torture, the war crimes, all these things kind of make a mockery out of what being American is supposed to be, is supposed to mean. And so who are we? In a way, we are all either living a lie or living nothing. And I'm trying to figure out how to stop living the lie that I live. So who are we and where do we go? What should we be doing? And there's no answer. There's no answer except that once we think we know, we failed. And that is one of the reasons that that I write a book without a beginning and end, and why I get on a train without knowing where the train is going to go.
Now, some of what you write about here talks of accomplishing this journey despite awkwardness and having a cracked pelvis and being slower than your companions. And I wanted to talk to you about conquering fear.
I'm an aging man, so I have a certain amount of grief to see my body decaying, my mind a little less sharp than it was. I know that it's a losing battle. It's also, again, very freeing in a way, because since we can't hold on to anything that we have, why struggle so desperately to safeguard it? Why not play a little bit? And the cost of failure is very, very low. The worst thing that can happen is death.
Now, the book lets all kinds of things happen, and happen suddenly, without telling the reader, now I'm going to imagine that I am seeing this plot of land for the very first time. Suddenly, Wyoming is unexplored territory, and I thought I'd ask you to read that passage because it leads to the understanding that we all live in different countries and we can't traverse each other's territory without an act of human imagination to accomplish that.
Yeah, I would enjoy reading that passage. I remember really getting that when I was reading Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi that he knew was completely gone, and whatever route I've taken on the freight trains is already gone, I'm sure.
This is William T. Vollman reading from Riding Toward Everywhere.
Since I am the first observer ever to have traveled in this unknown territory called Wyoming, I ought to describe the prairie's greennesses, undulations, wildcat oil wells, fences, hawks, and antelopes, some of which are black and white. Sometimes one can see the white desert sand beneath the grass. No human has ever been here. Other train riders must gain similar sensations. For after writing these lines in my journal, I read the following remarks of a Depression boy, who surely had survival on his mind, but could still feel the joyful wonder of hopping. Each time we crossed into another state, I felt like the early explorers. How can I say what I saw, heard, smelled, tasted, and felt in terra incognita? You may have visited Wyoming. You have probably seen grass. Very likely, you followed a fence. You could be familiar with the outlines of antelopes. But have you seen what I've seen? Did I see what Steve saw? The Tang Dynasty hermit poet Cold Mountain, who was named after the wild place he inhabited, wrote, "People ask the way to Cold Mountain. Roads fall short of Cold Mountain. Ice stays all summer. Fog dims the dawn sun. How did someone like me get here? Our minds are different. Otherwise, you could get here too." I never could have gotten to Cold Mountain because I lack Cold Mountain's mind. I love cities as much as solitude, prostitutes as much as trees, and I am proud that this is so. Neither the ecstatic openness of Kerouac's Road Voyagers nor the dogged cat-and-mouse triumphs of London's freight jumpers, and certainly not the canny navigations of Twain's Riverboat Youth define me. I go my own bumbling way, alone or in company, beset by lapses in my bravery, energy, and charity, knowing not precisely where to go until I am there. That afternoon, I was there, and those Wyoming hours have crystallized within my memory into a jewel of infinite depth whose contemplation brings me joy. I possess that rainy night walk with Steve into the Roseville yard and this thrillingly unbounded Wyoming afternoon, and I believe that I can hold eternity even without understanding it, because all afternoon we rode through green mounds of mystery with blue tableland ahead and rain clouds.
Bill Volman, reading from Riding Toward Everywhere, published by Echo. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with William T. Volman about Riding Toward Everywhere. Now, among the things that have been slivered and combined are the moments in the works of Mark Twain, Thomas Wolfe, Jack London, Jack Kerouac, that have had train riding experiences, even Ernest Hemingway, who doesn't seem to me to have many, but you have a beautiful story of his arrival at his Cold Mountain, and it seems that everyone in this book is searching for a version of theirs. And along the way, they encounter things that they're afraid of, that the world would consider to be trolls. And I'm wondering how it is here that people seem more afraid of these trolls, homeless, often helpless, hobos, and street sleeping people, seem more afraid of them than they do bankers and lawyers.
I think that up through the 40s, maybe, that the hobos had economic utility within the society, you would hear the phrase fruit tramps, that migrant workers might take the freights. And now that agriculture is mechanized, people have social security numbers and employers have to issue 1099s, it's not quite as easy for a fruit tramp to get hired. And so there aren't really very many fruit tramps. As a result, you rarely have a hobo knocking on your door asking if he can do something useful to get some money. And so if anyone knocks on my door, then I, a middle-class citizen, am going to be afraid. I'm not going to think of any possible transaction that can occur between myself and this person, I'm simply going to be afraid of him because I have and he doesn't have. So he might hurt me and take from me what I have. And this is it's probably a very common tragedy of industrial development, and it's certainly an American tragedy. You know, in part to be an American means to go out and seek for a little piece of paradise. The frontier closed officially around the turn of the 20th century, but we're still looking for it. We still love the idea that there's an economic frontier, a sexual frontier, an artistic frontier. Somehow we're trying to sublimate it. But all these frontiers are rather lonely, and we're less likely to meet people in our travels than ever before. So we become more narcissistic and solipsistic and more fearful.
Now, you met someone that you began to be a hobo with. In fact, he tells you that you are not, in fact, hobos at all. You're phobos. And he creates that word, named Steve, who has experiences hopping trains. Where and how did you meet him, and how did this friendship forge?
Steve is a wonderful, wonderful man, and he is not a hobo himself. He's definitely a phobo. He is an architectural designer. He's a very, very devout Christian. I am not. It is amazing that we get along. We really, really love each other. We have a great time together. When he gets off the leash, he is perhaps a real limb of Satan. He gets quite rash and brave and defiant. He's perhaps a little bit too brave, and I might be a little bit too cautious on the rail. So we make quite a good pair.
Now, the experience is frequently framed. It's night, and the open door of the car is casting shadows as the lights flow past, and one experiences in a crazy way the world in a frame. And a passage about that occurs early on in the book, and I'm going to ask Bill to read another passage for us.
Tree silhouettes against white sky, pallid sky, dim grass, house lights, the tremendous clatter of existence. These things brought me happiness as crystal clear as a vegetarian girl's urine. There came a brief stop on a trestle high above a night freeway, and it was like a lovely picture in a gallery. Now my life went on in the smell of metal, dirt, and old paint, and the skull smiled jawlessly upon me from the white wall. My flashlight discovered a tagline from La Grande, Oregon, a place with bittersweet associations for me. I had been there more than once with a woman whom I had deeply loved. She was the one who had thought it served me right to be punished by authority for failing to play the game a little. We left each other over that and other things. But how I'd loved her. There she was, written on the wall, which carried me through an infinity of other lives. And if I chose, I could go back to her, or at least beg her. I was riding through my dreams again. How long would it take to get to Oregon on the freights? 3 days, maybe. She and I had walked the tracks of the Portland Yard until a bull caught us. It hadn't been far from her house. I could easily get to her front door on foot. That was the journey I truly believed I could make, the journey into the past. It wouldn't do me any good to go to her now. I had to go to her in the time when she loved me. But I could, because riding the rails is time travel. Dark and lovely tree shadows raced across the long white gallery, and the shadows of my two comrades continually glided toward me, getting devoured by the pursuing shadow of the door frame. Then, all of a sudden, red signal luminescence rushed into the boxcar and flushed us with the blood of the entire world.
Now, that is such a great phrase, flushed us with the blood of the entire world.
Thanks, Michael.
But does that happen in a notebook as you're writing, in the imagination afterwards? And I want to ask you about that relation of writing to living. When does it take place? And then reading to writing and living, and traveling to reading, writing, and living. The books seem to have a suggestion that you have a mystical solution to how to accomplish all of these things simultaneously.
Well, when I read Huckleberry Finn, I like to lie down in the grass in the sunshine and feel as if it's a long, long summer afternoon, an endless, lazy afternoon, but also one that's going to be filled with purposes and perils. And to the extent that that I can, I try to have adventures on the rails filled with these purposes and perils, even though all of them are really quite meaningless. They're all in my head, just as the perils that Huck goes through are just a bunch of words. So I love that long, slow feeling of reading a book that I enjoy and getting caught up in that other world, and I try to write it that way as well. And at the same time, I can write in the dark. And that passage you had me read is based on something I wrote in my notebook in the boxcar. I couldn't see it as I wrote it, and so my pen was jittering crazily all over the notebook, and I had to turn pages when there might just be three or four huge scrawled line on the page so that I wouldn't overwrite. But then I was able to go back to these things that I was experiencing more or less unmediated by anything, and then approach them later in that that lazier, slower spirit. And some of those things just came into my head at the time, like the thing about the blood of the entire world. That was how it felt. It was a little bit like being in an optometrist's office, and suddenly I saw the projections of all the red blood vessels around my eyeballs, except it was so powerful and intense. Everything was bathed in a flush. It was like being with some woman I was making love with, and suddenly, she was just in this gorgeous, sweaty sex flush. The whole world was like that. It was exhilarating.
A final question. One of the many tracks the book follows is to question why train hop? Why escape? Why the question gets refined? Why the need to get out of here and that anxiety? And it changes. The answer changes as you go along. And part of the narrative of the book, if it has one, is the attempt to isolate and refine this question. Along the way, you provide us with a transcript of a Minnesota multiphasic personality test to let us know that the person being tested is normal, not insane. You know, he isn't doing this because of mental illness. And the word that gets used is an experience of freedom. But as I was reading, I thought that the word really was an experience of willlessness, that it takes so much will and direction to write a book, to decide to live a kind of life, to be anyone at all, and that what's wanted is the surrender of the will rather than the triumph of the will.
That's for sure, if you had to choose one or the other.
Giving up and being taken someplace you don't know how to go. And it reminded me of a time when you asked me and a bunch of other people, what book should I write next? No, really, tell me what to do. And I want the experience of doing something that's not of my choosing, that takes me to a place I don't know how to go and don't know how to get. And I thought, yeah, that probably is, you know, even for Thoreau and Twain, that with the American vision of manifest destiny, of continental will, there's the search for something completely willless, something even more than voluntary.
I think you're right. And willlessness, of course, entails formlessness. And so it's very difficult. It might be impossible to create willlessness or create from it. But if you could, then you could write Cold Mountain poems.
I've been speaking with Bill Volman, known as William T. Volman on the cover of books, and he is the author of Writing Toward Everywhere, and it's published by Echo. Thank you, Bill, for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Michael. I appreciate it.
It's always fun to be with you for me.
Yeah, I think you're the greatest.
You can read an excerpt from Writing Toward Everywhere at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director today is J.C. Swadek, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.